Welcome to Appointed.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be joined today by the amazing President Netan Obed. You've been president of ITK now for it's coming up to 5 years, and have done remarkable work amplifying and ensuring people know about the issues that face Inuit in Canada, in the area known as Canada, and really ensuring that the issues that are vitally important to those in the north are recognized throughout the country. And I've had the privilege and responsibility of listening and being witness to your testimony before Senate committees, as well as watching always with great interest, and finding myself always educated by your interventions. And in preparing for this podcast and speaking to you today, President, I had the opportunity to review the Inuit perspectives on the Canadian poverty reduction strategy that you worked on, and I was incredibly impressed with the complexity, but also the basic way in which you lay out what actually needs to happen in Canada for us to address the circumstances of Inuit who live within Inuit Nunangat, and the perspectives on poverty reduction and actions that need to be taken. So I wanted to start a bit there in terms of we're focusing on some issues around, you know, picking up on the perspectives and the recommendations, the calls for justice of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Inquiry, and in particular, the call to address some of the income disparity that exists through things like a guaranteed livable income, not in and of itself the only response, but as part of an integrated and fulsome response that would involve adequate social services, educational supports, as well as healthcare supports. And so we see it as integral to a system, but really replacing some of what have been really judgmental, often income supports that have been applied in a judgmental, not a universally accessible fashion. And so I want to start there. First, if you wanted to talk a bit about the work you've already done for a long period of time in this area, some of the recommendations you've made in the poverty reduction strategy, as well as how that links to this call for justice from the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Inquiry.
Thanks so much for that really warm introduction, Senator. I greatly appreciate that. And it's hard to believe that it's been almost 5 years that I've been in this role. I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to provide the Inuit perspective to the Government of Canada, to Canadians generally, but then also to push a lot of key issues that face Inuit towards our own self-determination, and then also to address systemic inequity that Inuit face in this country. Poverty and food security go hand in hand in a lot of the conversations that we have. And the statistics on food insecurity amongst Inuit are alarming, shocking, really. I mean, up to 70%. They vary across Inuit Nunangat, but between 55 to 70% food insecurity in relation to about 8%, 9% for Canada. Also overcrowding in housing, where we are at, depending upon the way you summarize data, we're over 40% of overcrowding in housing in relation to less than 5% for the Canadian population. So there are some fundamental building blocks for prosperity and well-being that just aren't there for Inuit. So when we take into consideration what the solutions are, and especially what the policy solutions are, a guaranteed livable income should be part of that consideration based on the systemic inequity that Inuit face in many aspects of our lives. National Inquiry into Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls was a truly one-of-a-kind inquiry in this country. I don't think that Canada fully comprehends how unique this particular exercise was from a structural standpoint, in which all provinces, territories, and the federal government had the agreement that this would be a truly national inquiry. And then the calls for justice that were the result of the inquiry should be seen as fundamental stepping stones towards ending the terrible reality of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls in this country. Calls for justice 4.5 and 16.20 both go hand in hand in relation to a distinctions-based Inuit-specific consideration for guaranteed livable income that take into consideration our culture, the way in which our traditional economy works, the way in which our traditional harvesting works, and then also the concerns that we always have around our cost of living, which is many times higher than the cost of living that most Canadians consider to be the baseline for policy. So all of these things need to be taken into consideration when we start to think about a guaranteed livable income in the purposes of reducing violence, but also in the purposes of ending social inequity for Indigenous peoples, specifically for the people that I serve, for Inuit.
Well, thank you very much for that. Just as an aside, one of the things that I know I've heard from you and read about you, and you know, you never know for sure if what you read is accurate, but one of the things that you're quoted as saying is that you hardly ever get angry. And it strikes me the kinds of injustices that the folks you represent, the people of the North, the Inuit throughout this country, both in the North and some who've migrated into the South for all kinds of reasons, including the inequalities you've raised. I am amazed at how the equanimity, the calmness, the patience you have in the face of this kind of injustice. I often describe myself as, you know, often frequently vibrating in rage and despair and trying to find the place for action. I think it's that equanimity that means many people hear what you say in a way that too many of the folks who are most marginalized often are discredited because their voices aren't heard. What are some of the ways that you see we could be amplifying and really are, you know, ensuring that the vision that you have, the vision and the incredible work that you've done is amplified here? And how could a guaranteed livable income be part of the solution, you know, for the work, all the recommendations you've made and all of the measures that you're trying to take in terms of poverty reduction and priority actions through ITK, but also, you know, personally and collectively with the folks you're working with?
There's many ways that I could answer that question. I think I'll start by giving you a sense of the way that I approach these really terrible issues. These issues that we shouldn't be dealing with in 2020, especially in a developed country like Canada. And this has been said thousands of times by First Nations, Inuit, and Métis leaders across this country that point out the systemic inequity and the injustice that is being perpetrated actively by the government of Canada and by provinces and territories in relation to the existing rights of Indigenous peoples and the inability for public government jurisdictions in this country to honor those rights, which are essentially human rights. The National Inquiry found that genocide was being committed against Indigenous women and girls in this country as one of its key findings. And the fact that Canada didn't even take that seriously was not surprising, but at the same time appalling. That immediately in the day after the release of the inquiry calls for justice, there could be editorial board responses from major media in this country who probably didn't have Indigenous peoples as part of their editorial boards. Mm-hmm. Most likely didn't have the depth and understanding from a purely reporting perspective to be able to come up with an editorial response within less than 24 hours on an issue as complex as genocide and the actual definition of genocide and how it was used within the report. But that just shows you a glaring example of how Canada thinks about itself very differently than how it acts. My role in many ways is to try to get Canadian government leaders, the Canadian public, to understand Canada in a different way so that we can pursue self-determination and social equity for Inuit. I have empathy for just about everybody that I meet, and the ignorance that most Canadians have about Indigenous peoples, and the ignorance that federal ministers and federal governments and provinces and territories have about the rights of Indigenous peoples, and the lack of respect that's shown from that ignorance, is something that is entrenched and systemic. So me being angry in the moment about it seems to be, for me and my purpose, in a place where I can get in these rooms, something that I should put aside and focus on getting them to understand their country in a different way. It requires, though, intelligence on the other side. And when I do get frustrated, it is when there the very real calls for equity are met with a lack of understanding or indifference. Mm-hmm. And that's when I get really frustrated with the conversations that we're having. So when I put it into perspective for poverty reduction for Inuit, the concept is not a very difficult one to understand or figure out. Our median income is roughly $18,000 per year in relation to close to 78,000 for all other non-Inuit who live within our homeland. The median income for Canadians generally, I believe, is over $60,000. So we have a fundamental problem, a problem that that government interventions like Nutrition North Canada aren't going to solve by themselves, and problems that specific educational programs or focuses on human resource development aren't going to fix either. There is a fundamental challenge that Inuit face within Canada to feed their families, feed our families, to have the opportunities afforded to most Canadians, and also to live in a way that will optimize the ability to have health and well-being. We have seen in other parts of the world, also here in Canada, most specifically with a research or a project that was done in Manitoba, that it is possible to have policy responses to poverty, and then also policy responses to a lack of well-being within a particular jurisdiction or a particular population. So it only makes sense for us to then pursue specific interventions that are distinctions-based, Inuit-specific, targeted to these challenges as a form of reconciliation, as a form of nation building, but also just as a form of the general respect that all Canadians believe that we have for one another. I know that this then becomes a party line conversation, and it quickly devolves into a conversation about a welfare state and a disincentive to work. But really, those are all, boogeyman excuses. Those are all policy considerations that any particular solution will take into consideration and guard against. It's just like within the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples conversation in this country. The idea that Indigenous peoples have a veto has been the first line that anyone opposed to UNDRIP legislation in this country uses. When the term veto does not exist within the UNDRIP text, the right to self-determine absolutely is a human right. So it is very convenient to twist the rights of Indigenous peoples into a risk for a particular sector of this economy or a particular sector of Canada. And it is very purposeful. And I think that you can juxtapose what happened and what it still happens with UNDRIP conversations, what is also happening with poverty conversations. That the fear of doing too much for an oppressed society or a society that is being denied their basic human rights actually drives the decision to do nothing. I don't think Canada is that country. I am still optimistic that Canada can do more to show its core values to Indigenous peoples and to the world. And this is one of these areas where I think we should start.
That's great. And I'm curious what the impact of the CERB, the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, as well as some of the other measures that were brought in during this pandemic have been, if any, to assist Inuit, and what you see as some of the options in addition to the ones we're talking about and that you've already mentioned could be taken. And I know that you've had an opportunity to look at the prospective document that we put forth through our office and to see if any of those areas we need to improve and should be adapting in particular to address the needs of Inuit.
Well, first, in relation to the CERB, this is one of these areas where there should be an Inuit Nunangat policy approach to the creation of this particular program. Any program or service, government support that specifically intends to include Inuit should take an Inuit Nunangat policy approach. There is no consideration for the cost of living for Inuit Nunangat communities within this particular benefit. And that is a huge challenge. The same could be said for the COVID response considerations for post-secondary education, for economic development, for food security. We still live in a time when the federal government and its 30 plus departments go their merry way when it comes to how they will consider First Nations, Inuit, and Métis within their broad mandate for a response to a particular policy issue. Some departments do it pretty well. I've worked well, and Inuit have worked well with Minister Miller at Indigenous Services. But then we have other departments that still basically live in a time when there was never really a consideration for Indigenous peoples in any government public policy. There was a consideration that there was an Indian Act and that in federal budgets, the government would find money to provide particular services in relation to their obligations under the Indian Act. But every other Indigenous person in the country could, you know, be a public citizen. And that just doesn't work. We see the outcomes in our socioeconomic status. There's no doubt that there is a correlation between the lack of specific policy considerations in government programmings with poor socioeconomic outcomes for Inuit. Because like it or not, everyone in this country, no matter how amazingly talented and inspirational your story is, that you didn't have support from government throughout. It's just the way that our system is set up, starting with the healthcare system. And that is something to be celebrated, but it also needs tweaking. It is built upon the backs of systemic racism against Indigenous peoples. And we still have not unraveled all of that and replaced it with distinctions-based targeted responses across governments. There's also some really excellent Government of Canada responses. So the Indigenous Community Support Fund, of which Inuit received $45 million to administer through self-determined ways, has done a great deal of good within Inuit Nunangak communities. There have been many food security measures that have been taken under funding for that, especially with traditional food and traditional harvesting. But also there have been incentives for Inuit to go on the land and go to their traditional places outside of communities in the spring and now in the summer to ensure that they're safe, but also that we can practice our culture. Another consideration in relation to cost of living and poverty and the ability to self-determine in the world on an individual level. 49 of our 51 communities are fly-in, fly-out communities for almost the entirety of the year. Inuvik and Tuktoyaktuk are connected to Southern Canada through road structures. No other communities are. Our Nunatsiavut communities in Northern Labrador have a ferry service that operates for the open water season. Runs, I believe, through June through November. But all other communities are strictly fly-in, fly-out. We don't have roads that connect our communities from the south to the north. We don't have railways. But at the same time, our airline systems are not considered essential. Therefore, there aren't the government investments to ensure that people can travel from one place to another. So a 3-hour flight, a direct flight between Iqaluit and Ottawa, return ticket costs roughly $2,300. And that is only one leg for a person who might live in North Baffin, a place like Mitimatulik, Pond Inlet, who would have to buy another multiple $1,000 ticket just to get to Iqaluit. This has tremendous impact on the well-being of people in this country and also the ability for people to self-determine. So there are so many different ways that we can address this. But at this time, the government of Canada, in its COVID response, has not provided a long-term solution to airlines that serve Inuit Nunangak communities. So there is a risk of sustainability. And it's not just about passenger travel, because there's not a lot of that happening right now. But most perishable food is flown into communities for the majority, if not every single day of the year. And the flights don't happen every day, but it is that our communities depend upon perishable goods being flown in every day. And then additionally, anything in regards to medical travel, including the administration of COVID-19 tests, or things such as births, any sort of medical emergencies, they depend upon sustainable air travel systems. So in the broader scheme of poverty reduction, those are the things that we have to think about as well. And I think that that would be a very foreign concept to most Canadians to think about the foundation of well-being systems and poverty reduction systems being airlines.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's part of the reason when we designed the perspectives document, we didn't talk about guaranteed livable income as being a panacea. And you have just articulated in very stark ways exactly why that is, that it's income is only one part of it. And it's part of why we also said we would need an income tested, need variations depending on where people are, which parts of the country. And in fact, in discussions earlier today with a number of international parliamentarians, many of us have talked about the fact that we need to be looking at centering the economy around human well-being, not merely the GDP in this country, and that some of what the inequalities and substantive challenges that have been laid bare by the pandemic have revealed that, you know, when we take a focus on health and economic and addressing economic and social inequalities and the environment, we actually see something that is far more rewarding than the way many countries have historically considered economic growth to be something at the expense of environmental degradation, massive social, economic, and health inequalities. And so that's a bit of what we were trying to capture in the perspectives document that we put out from our office. And part of it was fueled, as you may have heard me say before, when in visiting with folks in different communities, First Nations and Inuit, where elders and respected individuals within the community were talking about the inability of particularly young people, and you've talked about the numbers of young people, certainly in the poverty strategy, you talk about the fact that, you know, the high percentage of young people who are in the in the north, but also who don't have access to education and supports. And many of the elders talked about wanting to see ways, means for young people to be out on the land, doing some of the harvesting that you mentioned, learning culture, learning language, contributing to the community. But instead, particularly in some of the urban centers, being required to stay in community, ostensibly looking for non-existent jobs in order to be able to gain access to the government funding resources, whether it's social assistance or other forms of assistance. And so that was actually part of the impetus as well for us to put together this document, to try and argue that Indigenous peoples in this country should have some ability and need to be engaged in that process, obviously, as well as provinces and territories, in order to ensure that these measures are adapted to meet their individual needs. And my read of the calls for justice put out by the commissioners of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry was exactly along those lines. And I'm wondering if you read them that way, or if I have totally missed the boat, in which case I invite you to educate me and all of our listeners.
I completely agree with you that Indigenous self-determination, and just as it states right on the cover, reclaiming power and place, is the fundamental takeaway from the 1300 plus pages of the report. If Indigenous people and are governing structures, our communities, our culture, our languages, and our self-determination and human rights are respected, that is going to be the sustainable solution. There are all sorts of ways in which the inquiry considers how those things happen and how broader society, whether it be governments, regular citizens, businesses, and then jurisdiction, the city, so municipal, provincial, territorial governments, all can play very specific roles. And things like violence and policing, specifically considerations for Inuit and Northern policing and the RCMP. There are ways in which all those systems can help, but we won't get to the end goal until there is a broader self-determination than exists today for First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. If you look at government programs in regards to self-determination, we'll take Nutrition North. Every year, there's approximately $70 million that is dedicated to this particular program for Northern communities. It is one of the largest social programs that the federal government administers to a certain population in Inuit Nunavut. It isn't in any way linked to self-determination, though. The eligible items list is dictated by government. There might be advisory groups that are created that include Inuit and other Indigenous people from the eligible communities. But if we're looking at that particular program from a self-determination lens, basically the government of Canada would think very differently about the premise of the way at which it administers and expends funds in the guidelines for the program. Is it a social program? Or if it is a social program that is designed to help those most in need, then it isn't that right now. Mm-hmm. But most Canadians and most parliamentarians, most businesses, look at it on the surface and say, wow, look at that. We're doing a great job. But people don't stop to think about it in the lens of self-determination. And if you did that first for everything that are programs that affect Inuit, then we get some change. Because first you say, okay, well, who decides the eligible items? Okay. How is that self-determining for Inuit and Inuit Nunavut? Immediately, the very first thing, that would be the red flag to then rethink the way the government of Canada functions when it comes to that particular program. And we could go across any of the interventions. The justice system is rife with them as well. We can transform these things if we just ask the right questions first, and then public policy can be improved based on taking the necessity of Indigenous self-determination or human rights into consideration as the very first consideration. And that's what the inquiry did. And I think it's quite powerful, especially in the second volume, to read all of the different Indigenous community-based programs that are best practices, that are saving lives, that are building communities, that are entrenching customs and traditions. They exist on the fringes, and they are not supported because, systemically supported, because that question is never asked first about, are we upholding Indigenous self-determination in this program that is meant to help Indigenous people.
So the fact that the missing and murdered Indigenous women commissioners came out in support of guaranteed livable income as part of that frame wasn't a surprise to me in that context, because so much of, as you've just indicated, from Nutrition North to social assistance schemes to other funding arrangements really are hinged on ideas of individuals often who have a great deal more privilege, resources, and opportunities than those who are accessing the programs decide who deserves them. And it's based on that kind of model rather than allowing communities to develop the resource allocation around the needs that are identified. And coming back to your poverty reduction strategy again, you've made a number of recommendations about housing and infrastructure, climate and food security, some of which you've already discussed. How do you see, guaranteed livable income being something that would work well in the North in conjunction with the many other recommendations you've made? Or is it something that you think is also we should be rethinking in terms of different approaches, recognizing that the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Inquiry and the commissioners were trying to develop a number of recommendations and calls for justice that would apply as broadly as possible. How do you see it working to supplement, to support, to perhaps invigorate or amplify some of the other areas that you have determined communities could take on, would take on, that could try and alleviate the incredible economic marginalization that exists right now for so many Inuit?
And I'll start there. The current system is not founded upon the recognition that Inuit have experienced both social inequity and inequitable outcomes in respect to economic, social, and cultural well-being. And that has just been since the very beginning of the relationship of Inuit and Canada. So we'd like to replace that with a system that does recognize not only those huge challenges that have come from colonization in the economic, social, and cultural senses, but also that these impacts are not only being felt by Inuit today, but they're intergenerational. And I'll give the example of housing in this country. And housing in most developed countries is a wealth generator. And it also is something that is the first place where people consider intergenerational wealth to start, if there isn't any that they're building from. So for Inuit, very few Inuit own our own homes in Inuit Nunavut. It's prohibitively expensive. Our communities are very small. There isn't a lively housing market because of that. And also, the government and government policies make it very difficult for housing markets to be created that are similar to those in the South. There aren't housing inspectors that are readily available for a government service. Usually individuals have to pay for that particular service and fly those people up. There aren't inspection processes and protocols in place. There are many lenders, many banks that won't service Inuit specific populations. Because of particular rules and also because we are so far afield and the insurance risks that banks are unwilling to take for certain communities or certain realities. So we have an entire system that basically pushes people into government housing or subsidized housing. And then we have governments, most particularly provincial territorial governments and the federal government, who create disincentives for private homeownership through through subsidizing rent for employees. So you have then very expensive rental units, prohibitively expensive home ownership options, and then social housing, which is what most people are forced into. This is a fundamental problem, and we've created a housing strategy with the Government of Canada. That strategy is now almost a year old, and there hasn't been much meaningful work done to implement it. There are periodic investments for social housing, but it is completely inadequate in relation to the particular need. So we do need to transform our systems to ensure that the Inuit have a chance to live healthy lives. And some people want to own their own homes. Some people want to take on that Canadian mindset of passing on intergenerational wealth. I mean, really, our wealth was passed on through knowledge. And now we are faced with unenviable situations where sometimes we have to choose between that knowledge, gaining that knowledge, the traditional knowledge about how to live sustainably in our homeland, with a wage economy. And this is a time, I think, where we can reconsider all of that. So the self-determination within that conversation is so important. We need to remove barriers, and we need to change the current welfare systems and benefit systems. And part of that, I think, is empowering people through something like a guaranteed livable income. Welfare and social assistance is not meant to provide a living wage to its recipients. In many cases, I would imagine the public policy behind social assistance is that you help people through tough times, that it is a safety net so that people who are between jobs or can't find work at the present moment will be able to get by until they do find work. But in a lot of our communities, it is something that is used as a more permanent solution that it was never intended to. And that is just the way in which the program is being used in some circumstances. And I think there should be a more Inuit-specific consideration of how measures taken to ensure well-being amongst our population are crafted and what they are for, and that they need to be specific and intended for the policy response that they're being used for. Right now, it's just as if people are shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, that's the system we have, and there's not enough money to do any more, and keep hoping for a different outcome, when the system is creating a stream of negative results that I believe won't change without a vast overhaul of the system.
Well, thank you for that very rich and vital response. One of the challenges we were trying to address, and I think many who have ventured down this path have been trying to address, is exactly what you've just underscored, the fact that social assistance across this country was aimed at providing a safety net for folks and really to assist people to get a leg up and out of poverty in contexts where they ended up in situations where they were without work, without education, all of those realities, and yet has developed a stigma because, in part, it has created intergenerational dependence and has created a system whereby people are essentially blamed for their own inability to extricate themselves from poverty while they're entrenched in a system that its entire purpose appears to be to keep people in poverty rather than really provide what was originally intended was a leg up and out of poverty. And so, as you mentioned earlier, one of the we have a few examples in Canada where a basic income type of approach has been implemented for short periods of time as pilots. And we've seen situations where individuals were able to obtain education, use the time to take care of whether it's their children or those who have disabilities in their families or the elderly. They've been able to use the time to gain other skills that may not be related to school, but related to culture, language, and the like, and have provided opportunities for people to move out of the situations of economic deprivation they were in. And so it strikes me as one of the ways that this we could move, and certainly some jurisdictions like Prince Edward Island as provinces and British Columbia are looking at these options. I'm extremely concerned when I hear that the government is instead looking at more patchwork approaches and potentially building up things like employment insurance, that in fact we are continuing on this path which has colonial, racist, class-based roots of determining that we will only help or assist or provide supports for those who we deem blameless. I can't think of a more problematic construct to start with. I think I could continue on a conversation with you forever, but I will resist that impulse. Is there anything else you'd like to add, President Obed?
No, I just wanted to really thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I admire your work as well, and I am and remain optimistic that we can build a better society within this country, and we can do more to reduce poverty, to end food insecurity, and to implement the existing rights of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis at the same time.
Thank you for that. I share your optimism. It's part of the reason I continue in this role and accepted this role when I had the opportunity. And I want to thank you for the incredible leadership that you have shown well before being in the position you are now, and that I know you will continue both as president of ITK, but also as a phenomenal leader and inspiration for so many in this country. Thank you.